I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. Page 63 is the formal terms of surrender, the third step prayer. Right after the third step prayer, it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. My sponsor had me read, got on this kick about self-centeredness and running the show, and had me read this part of the book over and over again. And I had a little awakening in that process where I could finally, I couldn't see it at first, but after one day when I was having a bad day, I read that part of the book and I could see it was me, the actor wanting to run the whole show, forever trying to arrange the lights, the scenery, the rest of the players in his own way. It's funny how you, if you're like me, you can read that. It's only about other people. And then if you're having a really bad day, sometimes you can read it and all of a sudden it's I'm the guy who's trying to arrange what people are doing in traffic and in work and in the meetings. I'm the guy. And so I got down on my knees and I said the third step prayer. And I'm going to read it on page 63. And if you'd like to say it along with me, feel free. God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Well, I got up off my knees after saying that prayer, and the next 10 months of my life were insane. They were chaotic. I was crazy. I was so consumed with anxiety and periods of depression and more than 10 months, but the first 10 months after doing the third step prayer was crazy. And what happened, and shortly after doing that, I lost my job. Now, this is not just a job for me. This is what I think is going to be my life. I've decided and judged to be my lifelong career. I was working in a treatment center as a counselor. I thought this is what I wanted to do the rest of my life. Not only did I lose that job, but I could not get another job in the counseling field, in any venue, anywhere. I put resumes everywhere. Every single door was closed. Now, with that job, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. Now, I'm no job. Well, right after that, my roommate moves out. Now, with the job and the roommate splitting half the bills and utilities, I'm living paycheck by paycheck. Now, I got homelessness coming at me. There was a girl that the first girl I ever dated, and she dumped me around that same time. I talked a little bit about that earlier. That made me nuts. I started going through these emotional upheavals like crazy stuff. It was like I'd just be sitting somewhere. I'd be sitting at home watching a TV show. Not even an emotional TV show. I'd just start sobbing as if emotions that were pent up in me for like a decade or two were just starting to come out. They're not coming out nice. And it's freaking me out. I went to my sponsor in the midst of all this insanity and I telling him what was going on. He says, oh, you're right on course. I thought, Jesus, for what? A train wreck. I'm gonna be on the streets any day now. I'm behind in my rent, my utilities. I'm in danger of getting the power shut off, being evicted. I have no job. And I'm emotionally whacked. And what I don't know is that God was doing exactly what I asked Him to do in the third step prayer. When I said, to him that I would that I was offering myself to him for him to build with me and to do with me as he wills. And God took that serious, and he started building with me and doing with me. And what is making me crazy is not what's actually going on. It's my judgment and opinion of what's and perception of what's going on that's making me nuts. The problem is God Star has a plan, and he doesn't consult me. He doesn't send me the blueprints and say, Bob, I'd like to get your approval on these changes I'm going to make in your life. He never did that. If he'd have called me up and said, Bob, that job, that's a bad job for a recovering alcoholic. Because from the moment you took that job working as a counselor, you became unsponsorable because you thought you were a big shot professional. And from the moment you took that job as a counselor, you no longer wanted to do 12-step work because you kept telling yourself you did it all day long. You got to get out of that job. Bob, we're gonna get you out of that job because down the road here a little bit, you're going to get a job working as a cashier in a store, and eventually one day you're going to own a chain of stores and you're going to be able to retire young and you'll be set for life. Would that be okay for you, Bob? But he didn't say that. He just took the job. If he had called me up and said, you know, that roommate, we want to get that roommate to move out because there's a guy from Florida that's moving to Las Vegas. And he's going to look to share an apartment with somebody, and you guys are going to be roommates for several years. And the two of you together will be going to do a lot of 12-step calls. They're going to call you Batman and Robin, and you're going to help a lot of people and do a lot of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to take your program to a new level. Would that be okay for you, Bob? He didn't say they just took the roommate. If he would have said, you know, that girl that you're dating, she's going to drink down the road a little ways, and if you're with her, chances are you'll join her. We got to get her out of there. I just said, good, get her out. And Bob, you've had emotions pent up in you for a long time, and they're constipating your spirit. We got to free up. I just said, okay, God. But he didn't say any of that stuff. He just started building with me and doing with me. And everything that happened, absolutely everything, was perfect. I should have been rejoicing for everything that happened. What was making me sick inside and overwhelmed with fear and feeling at times like I'm going to die here, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown, was not what was really going on. What was really going on was perfect. It's my judgment and my perception of my ego and its commitment to being right that is making me nuts. It's making me nuts. Everything that was happening was perfect. When I say in the third step prayer, what I'm really doing is I'm trying to surrender one thing above all. It's the first thing. It's my will. I'm not dancing. My friend Charlie says that he thinks the will is the thinking. I think it's more than that. I think the will is the ego's judgment of life. It's my judgment, you know, that makes me nuts. I'm crazy because I'm judging the loss of this job to be bad. I'm judging the loss of the roommate to be bad. I'm judging the loss of the girlfriend to be bad. I'm judging the emotions that I'm feeling to be bad, and it's all good. I'm wrong. And the reason that I became the guy who used to go to meetings and say, I don't know what's wrong with me. I turn it over and take it back. I never turned it over. I had made a decision to turn it over, but I didn't turn it over because I hadn't worked the rest of the steps yet. I had not started to dismantle the ego, the judgment machine in step four to see how wrong I'd been about everybody. How wrong I'd been about life itself. And so consequently, I'm still right. I'm still right about a lot, and I'm in a lot of trouble. If I were to surrender, if I could carry out the decision in step three, then I would live the life at its simplest level. I would be a divine receiver of all of God's graces and gifts. I think that sometimes I am like the guy who God's trying to give a brand new Bentley to, and I'm saying, leave me alone. I'm trying to get this old Volkswagen to run. I can't see past my willful judgments and agendas to receive the gifts. I think that the gifts are bothering me because I got a judgment on what you're doing. I got a judgment because I'm so full of myself. And that's the problem. Spiritual growth does not come from addition. It always comes from subtraction. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of self-abandonment. And one other thing, something that I didn't get right away. I was sitting with a guy, God, I was 10 years sober. And I'm sitting with a guy that I sponsor, and we're going through the steps, and we get to the third step, and we're going through pages 60 through 63, and we're talking about the actor and the self-centeredness and all that stuff. And we get to the third step prayer, and I said, before we say this, I want to see if you know what you're going to do here, what this is, what you're about to say and make the decision on. I want you to tell me what you think the third step prayer means. And he reads the first line. He says, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. He says, I guess what I'm doing is making a decision to make my life none of my business. It's now God's business, the course it takes. It's for him to build and him to do with me as he sees fit. I'm out of the loop. I have to try to make it none of my business. And then he says something. He says, look, reads the next line. He says, I guess the next line's right because I'm so concerned with myself that I need God to relieve me of the bondage of self. I like that word bondage. I'm shackled to my own addiction with myself. I think there's a grandfather obsession that's underneath the obsession for alcohol, drugs, gambling, money, sex, property, prestige, being right. Isn't the grandfather obsession of them all? Isn't that first and foremost, I'm obsessed with myself, my feelings, my security, my judgments, my life, what you think of me? Isn't it really all about me? And so I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage because I am shackled and a hostage to my own obsessive self-involvement. Earlier in the book, it uses a term that I didn't... There's a funny line in here. It says we're extreme... It uses the word extreme. Extreme examples of self-will run riot. I think to say that we're extreme is a little extreme, actually. I mean, why don't they be nice and just say, Bob, sometimes, you know. No, they say, Bob, you're off the charts. And then it says, here's the kicker. This is how I qualify. You know how if you qualify as an extreme example of self-will run riot? Because of the next line. It says, though we usually don't think so. I've never in my whole life, in the middle of a self-will binge, or known anybody in the middle of burning their life to the ground sober, in the middle of a self-obsessed self-will binge, who's ever in the middle of it went, maybe I'm an example of self-will run riot. I never think that. I think I'm right. We usually don't think so. And then he reads this next line, and here's where he floors me. Now, I'm over 10 years sober at this point. I had been saying the third step prayer as part of my morning routine for 10 years. And I don't understand the prayer. Now, I don't know how you could be a knucklehead enough to say a prayer 365 days a year for 10 years and not know what you're saying, but I got to tell you, I didn't get it. And this new guy says to me, he reads the last line, he says, "Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, may I do thy will always." And he looks at me and he says, "Oh, we're doing all of this just so we can help other people?" And I'm over 10 years sober, and I'm sitting there going, holy shit. I didn't get it. I got take away my difficulties. Yeah, I get that. And I got a list, too. But it says, difficulties with what? With the bondage of self. As a matter of fact, from this moment on, we're going to inventory as a way of life manifestations of self that keep me hostage. I'm asking him to take away my difficulties with the bondage of self so that victory over that, these manifestations and these difficulties will bear witness to those I would help. That sounds like a contractual agreement. I'm asking God, making a decision for self-abandonment in the first line. I'm asking God, if you will relieve me of the bondage of self, do it so that I can help your kids. Now, I wouldn't have wrote the prayer like that. I would have said, take away my difficulties so victory over them would let everyone realize what a wonderful guy Bob is. Or take away my difficulties so I'll be rich and famous. Or so I'll be happy. Don't I get happy? No, we get something better than happy. Something much better. We get usefulness. I tell you, I've been happy. It's fleeting. The shine of it wears off very quickly. I'll take usefulness. I'll take the feeling after I've spent a day trying to help others that I can put my head on the pillow and feel one with and at peace. I'll take that. I think that's the best feeling a guy like me ever gets. Because when you're useful, you're connected and a part of and one with. Did you ever notice in the ninth step promises, it makes an unusual promise. It says that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. It doesn't say that feeling of uselessness and that feeling of self-pity, because they're connected. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity. When you're useless and you're not worried, all you think about is you and you're of no use to anyone else, self-pity is part of that territory. Part of the territory. There's something, self-involvement leads itself to self-pity and depression all the time. I don't like the word depression. I don't like the word self-pity. I like the word depression better. The word self-pity is a pitiful word. It's not a manly word. Self-pity. You ever hear somebody in AA say, when you're having a bad day, say, "Oh, you're just feeling sorry for yourself. Don't you want to hit them?" It's a horrible word. It's a horrible word. I like depression. Depression is, if you've got depression, my God, you can go to a bar and tell your friends at the bar that you're clinically depressed. They'll buy you a drink. They don't buy you nothing for being sorry for yourself. You got depression, they'll give you pills for depression. They don't give you crap for self-pity. And if there's a difference, I can't see it. I'm colorblind. Every time I was diagnosed as being clinically depressed, I was really full of self-pity. Because of my life. It's not going my way. Nobody ever treats me right. What about me? Oh, come on, I'm not happy. Always, you just feel that I'm the center of the universe when I'm like that. Right? I'm the center of the universe. Self-obsessed, self-involved. See, I don't think Alcoholics Anonymous is a self-help program. I don't think it ever was, is not, and ever will be. I think it's a program of self-abandonment and service. I think one of the reasons that self-help doesn't work for alcoholics is it takes us in the wrong direction. We're not trying to enhance self or help self. We're trying to abandon self. If you had someone running your business who keeps stealing from you, you don't send him to school. You get him out of there. Oh, he's robbing me blind. I'm going to educate him. He'll be able to rob me more efficiently. That's why I went to so much therapy, it almost killed me, because I'd be brutal. I had to hold this head full of education about psychology, and all it was fodder and information for my disease. It just made the thing I'm trying to get away from stronger. My ego will use anything. Even in sobriety, at times it used the big book. As I started to learn about the book and the steps, my ego used the steps, used the big book, and it used the traditions to self-grandize itself. And I bet you there's a lot of people in this room who had that same experience. You take the best things that have ever happened to you, the things that have changed your life, and you'll sit in a meeting, and all of a sudden your ego goes, what's a shame, he doesn't have a good program. Right? Just to, you can feel yourself puffing up with your ego, puffing up, using the program to puff you up. So this is really self-abandonment and service. The bottom of page 63, it talks about, I'm going to just talk about this and then move on to Ralph. It says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which was a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted, though our decision, third step, was a vital and crucial step. And it is. It is the turning point. It is not the turn. It is the turning point. Crucial step. It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Blocking me from what? Blocking me from carrying out the decision in step three. I could get on my knees in the morning and with all the sincerity I'm capable of, turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and 5 minutes later, I'm in my head running the universe. I can't carry it out because I'm blocked. And I'm blocked from the God within me that promises that I can connect with on page 55. And if I could just clear away the stuff that's obscuring me. I have no conscious contact with God. God's become some ethereal thing separate and apart from me. Something up here in the sky or out there somewhere in the ether. I am blocked from God. And I am blocked from other people. I became, by the time I was 4 years sober, I was suffering periodically from depression. I worried a lot. I would wake up sometimes afraid. And not the kind of make you run down the street screaming fears. Just wake up anxious. I'd wake up worrying. Open my eyes and my head would start scenarios about stuff that I was worrying about. I was having a harder time getting along with people. I couldn't seem to get anything in the relationship department. I couldn't get along with people at work, really. I'd become very self-righteous, and I was using everything I'd learned in AA as a weapon to beat other people over the head with. You know what the problem with self-righteousness is? Self. Let me tell you something. If you got the same disease I got, anything, any word that has the word self in it is not a good deal. It's not, there's nothing, there's self-righteous, self-seeking, self, there's nothing with self in it that's good for my spirit. I was blocked from other people. I remember there were times when I would sit in meetings and I would know that a whole bunch of people were going out to coffee after the meeting and nobody'd ask me. I'd sit. I was very serious at that point. A guy at the TIE Club in Las Vegas accused me of having my sense of humor surgically removed. Well, self-obsessed, self-centered people, there's nothing funny. I had it in it. When you're the center of the universe, there's nothing funny about you because this is a big deal. Everything's a big deal. Big deal. I couldn't laugh at myself. And if you can't laugh at yourself, life is boring. Because you are the center of entertainment in your life. You just don't know it yet. I'm telling you. I have a friend that says when you can learn to laugh at yourself, you'll always be amused. And so I was blocked. And we had to get down to causes and conditions. And the fourth step is the beginning of a process that Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about when he'd say this is a process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding. I think you can't ask God to take anything away that you're not awake to the fact that it's there. You can't solve a problem you don't have. And so this is the beginning of the discovery process. Uncover, discover, and discard. Ralph?
Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsellable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of a business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. Fact-finding, fact-facing process. Effort to find out the truth about the stock in trade. What's my stock in trade as a person? What's my stock in trade? Well, generally speaking, what usually motivates me is my thinking, my thoughts, and my actions. Stock in trade. That's what I operate on. Later on, what I'm going to really discover is the truth about my belief system. And so I'm going to take a look at my stock in trade, and I'm going to take a look at it honestly. And when Bill wrote the book, he described this process of inventory, and he compared it to a commercial venture. And he said a commercial inventory, he talked about it being fact-finding and fact-facing. And if you run a business, you probably need to see what you got in there. And let's just say, for example, I got Best Buy, something like that, and I'm running this business. And obviously, I don't want my business to go broke. I want to be successful at that business, right? I want to make money. I want to sell items in that business. We're in a technological age, and we know that Best Buy is probably selling. I got this truck coming, and it's going to bring in the latest MP3s and DVDs and somebody, Xboxes and PlayStations and all of the regular toys, tools, and gadgets, the latest Dell computer, all that stuff. Okay, so I got all that coming in. And those are things to sell. People want them. You know, people want to keep up with what's selling right now, and so people want them. I want to sell them because I'm running a business and I'm in the business to make money. Now, I need room on my shelves to do this, but I don't have room on my shelves. And one of the reasons I don't have rooms on my shelves is because I haven't done an inventory. I don't know. So why are my shelves still full all the time? Well, I got a lot of stuff, obviously, that's not selling. So I go through and I look up and I got 8-tracks on my shelves. I got reel-to-reels on my shelf. I got Betamaxes. They never sold. And still, I got Betamaxes sitting up there. And until I take a look at it, I'm like, my store is full. I'm coming. And so I got to go through and I take inventory. Some of the stuff never sold. Unsellable goods. Nobody, Betamaxes went out before they were ever in. You know, and now, you know, and reel to reel, they had their day. Turntables, they had their day. Their day is past. You know, some of the stuff is pristine condition, but it's not selling. Unsellable goods. Some of the stuff, I have some new DVDs and recorders, but somebody came in there like Steve, and he stole and came back and brought it back broke. You know, so I got some damaged stuff. Some of you guys came in browsing, and you dropped it and put it back on the shelf. I got some damaged items on the shelf, too. Nobody's going to buy those either. So they equally, and I can't lie to myself about values. There's no need me telling myself, we're going to have a return to real players one day. I'm going to keep them. No, that stuff's not coming back. So I go through the shelf, and I can't lie to myself about values. What does that have to do? You know, some people in here, if I make it on a personal level, I got a closet, ladies, you know, you got to walk in, and your closet's full. No room in it at all. And I'm sitting up in here, you know, in my closet, and I got all these size 30 pants. I'm not going back to 30, you know. I could keep it in my mind. It's been a long time, you know. Ralph, it ain't happening no more. You know, got some platform shoes in there. Never been worn, but they're mine and they're new. You're not wearing platforms anymore, no. Unless they got an old 70s party or something. You're not wearing that stuff anymore. So I go through my closet and I get rid of it. Doesn't matter that it still looks good. Bob, that Nehru jacket, it does not matter that it still looks. Get rid of that stuff, you know. Just get rid of it. You know, and so I go through it. Well, what does that have to do, Ralph, with my thinking, with my life, with my thoughts and my actions? Well, some of the same thing. You know, pouting looks good on a 3-year-old. You're 55. They're not buying that, Ralph. That idea that when somebody hurts your feelings, you pout or you withdraw. Or you retell, ain't nobody buying that act. Nobody's buying it. And so some of the same things, and that's a quick example, some of the same things in my life. And I go through inventory. So a business that does not take regular inventory will go broke, you know. And so I kind of imagine this deal, you know, and I look at this deal as if there's something in it for me. Remember, I'm not free of my defects of character yet, right? So I let them work for me. I let them work for me at this point. It's something in it for me. I kind of imagine it like Santa. If Santa Claus didn't have a sleigh, if he drove a truck. I imagine he drove a truck and he said, Ralph, I got all this brand new stuff for you. I got brand new stuff, but you got to get rid of your old stuff. I got a whole truckload, furniture, toys, computers, printers, all the stuff you like, big screens and stuff, but you got to clear out the stuff that's in there so we can make room for it. Sounds good in theory. The only difference is, and it's a small one, God don't drive a truck and I can't see him. God doesn't drive a truck and I can't see him. So what I got to first be convinced of is that my old stuff's not working for me anymore. And just be willing to believe that there's something new for me. That's where all of us come in. Because I see you guys walking around with a new way of handling things. I see you not blowing up when somebody says something to you that's out of line. I see you being able to take criticism like a man and not going to a shell and retreat. I see you in interactions with other people and doing it like grown people do. I want that kind. I want those. I want that. I want that. That's the kind of life I want. That's my business, my life, you know, so I see it going broke. So I get into this deal, and so now a little bit later on it says we did exactly the same thing in our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. There's that being convinced deal again. Before I embark on inventory, one more time, if my life run on my wheel is successful, don't bother with it. If I'm not convinced that my life run on my wheel is not, don't bother with inventory. It's one of the things that's at the front end of inventory that I got to be willing. I got to remember, I'm convinced that my life run on my wheel is not successful. Self manifested in various ways. Bob did a lot of talking about self. And of course, me being an alcoholic, I had to rise to the challenge. Bob said, every self word is a negative. Why? And then I started thinking, self-loathing, yeah. Self-absorbed, yeah. Self-delusions, yeah. You know, I'm like, oh, why did he have to be right? But I found one.
What's that?
Selfless. You'll hear people talk about this. You hear people talk about it's a selfish program. It's a selfless program. Only word, only one. And I trust me, when Bob said it, I've been like, ooh, self-absorbed. I was self-absorbed thinking about it, right? So anyway, let's get back. Self manifested in various ways. And then the book talks about, let's look at the common manifestations of self. Let's look at the ways that you see Ralph show up in his interactions with other people. Let's look at the ways that you'll see the way that I've gone about destroying my life. And there are three common areas that we look at when we do inventory. These are big areas. These areas are so big that if I take a look at those areas, I guarantee you my life will change. It'll transform. And Bill talks about three areas of self. The way Ralph shows up in his interactions with folk, you know, in my life. Resentments, fears, and sex conduct. It's just called a sex inventory. People take it as a shortcut, but really a sex conduct. Resentment and fears and sex. Three big areas. It talks about resentment is the number one offender. It has the power to kill more alcoholics than anything else. From it, it stems all forms of spiritual disease because, you know. And so it talks about this business of resentment, and that's the first inventory that I look at. Resentment. Help me. Somebody, what's a resentment?
You relive something over and over.
Relive something over and over. I had sex with a girl. I liked it. I think about it over and over. Ooh, is that a resentment? You're on the right track to relive, but it's got another aspect to it, because I relive a lot of good times over and over too.
To refill.
To refill what?
Reoccurring thought of discontent.
Reoccurring thought of discontent. Somebody else.
Be mad at someone for your feelings about their behavior or action.
Be mad at somebody about their feelings or behavior or action. Let's do it like the game shows. We got a piece of it. To refill. To refill a hurt or refill an injury. To refill hurt or refill injury. Bill says, I was burned up. I was hot. I was mad. And to refill that anger. It's not enough to just get mad, let it go away. That's how people handle stuff. Everything that I feel, everything as a person that I feel has a reason for it. It's an instinct. It's a human instinct. I cannot walk through life and never know anger again. In fact, some of those instincts, the adrenaline rush that comes, if a mother sees them, if I'm walking on the street, and if I see one of these molester guys grab my daughter, I'm going to instantly get scared, and I'm going to instantly get angry. And the adrenaline rush that comes from that is going to propel me into some action. It's an instinct. There are some instincts. So I'll never be free of anger, and I'll never be. But this business of resentment takes it a little further. This business of resentment has to do with refilling a hurt, and resentment doesn't matter whether the hurt is real or imagined. Resentment has the same effect on Ralph, whether it's real or fancy. You know, it could be a real resentment. Bob could actually do something to me that I think injured me. And I could really be angry at him, you know. In fact, probably he may share an example of something that really happened in his life that would cause a person to really get angry. Somebody could really do something. Somebody could really go to the boss, want my position, lie on me to get it, you know. On the other hand, I could walk in this door. I could see you two sitting there. I could see Clark and his girl sitting there talking. They look at me. They turn their head. They start laughing. I know he was talking about me. I know it. And then I think about it, because that's what I do with a resentment. I rethink it and I refeel it. And when I think about it, that whole row of people there kind of joined in with him, you know. And they supposed to be my crew. What they doing hanging with Clark now and taking his side in this, you know? And so now I leave here, and that's how resentments really do grow. And then I'm sitting up here, and as I get in my car to leave the meeting, I can see the expression on Clark's face again. And it's like in my head, it gets different. Plus he smirked, you know, and he's, you know, he smirked. What was that about? You know, and then when I get, you know, and then now all you people, and pretty soon when I mushroom it enough, it's enough of you people against me at my home group, and now I stop going to meetings with you, all you fakes and phonies and Alcoholics Anonymous that claim that you for my best interest, but all you're doing is backbiting and backstabbing me and talking about me, and I leave my help. And that's a far-fetched example, but it's an example that happens every day, and that's why it talks about it. Resentments have the power to actually kill. I leave my help. I leave the hospital. I leave it because you guys, I know, you guys were real. You weren't real anyway, and nobody is for my best interest. You know those people up there are fakes, and they talk about people. And they get up to the podium, and they act one way, and they don't walk like they talk, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm there. And that resentment right there has as much power, and Clark was probably talking to her about where they're going out to dinner. Doesn't matter. The resentment is in me. I have a friend that says, harboring a resentment is like me taking the poison and waiting on you to die. I have another friend that says, when I have a resentment at you, it's like me keeping you in prison, but I got to stand guard. I'm right up in there with you. You know, resentments, you know, we think that. And so that this business of resentment, the book has real strong term to it. We think it's infinitely grave. It's fatal. Do I believe resentments kill me? We said resentments out of power to kill. Do I believe resentments actually out of power to kill? Somebody said, mm-hmm. Believe it, huh? But every now and then, I bet somebody deserves to get cussed out every now and then, right? They need a good one, and I'm just the person to do it, too. You know, because every now and then, if you let them get away with this one, won't they try the next one? And won't they come at you twice as hard the next time? Oh, I thought you said you believe resentments have the power to kill. And now all of a sudden, you're like, yeah, they need one. You know, I don't. Wait a minute. You want to commit suicide up in there? You know, I don't always believe resentments hurt me. Sometimes I believe resentments work for me. Sometimes I believe resentments work for me. Many people in here are in a relationship with another person. Sometimes I don't even have to be mad, but sometimes you do something to me and I think if I don't get mad, you'll try it again and get away with it. So I need to act mad just to keep you in check. Oh, now you, what's all this nodding from Miss I believe resentments kill me over here? Absolutely, I understand. I'm saying that's my point. I look at myself, and so when I read these, I match it up against my experience, and I find out, wait a minute, sometimes I think resentments work for me. Why do you think I keep getting them? I've done about 17 inventories. I still get resentments. Sometimes I think they work for me, and sometimes I do it, and Bob already said it. You know, self can't overcome. I'm a human person, and I'm in a human condition. And some of this, the good news is, I get, but sometimes I think they work for me. You know, so when I do this deal in resentments, when I do this resentment inventory, there are three or four things I need to remember. The first thing I need to remember, because now we are on the mission to deflate the ego. This inventory process, that's primarily what it's about. Abandonment of self. And guess what? My ego is going to fight to live. My ego is going to fight to live. So there have been people in here who have been saying, I'm going to do inventory, and just have not got around to doing it yet. Just have not quite gotten around it, and that's common, because that's that ego fighting to live. And it gets manifest in a couple of ways. First is fear. I can't look. You've been living the way I'm living, and you've been doing some of the things I'm doing. I cannot take a look. And then fear's twin brother, pride, pops up and says, plus you don't have to. You've been operating all this time without it. You don't have to. So when I do inventory, that's the first thing I need to know. My ego is going to fight for its life, right to live. And it rebuilds awfully fast. You know, so if fear shows up, I can't take a look. Pride steps in and tells me I don't have to. Then the other deal in doing inventory. Being free of a resentment does not mean I'm excusing, condoning, or exonerating the behavior that brought it on. Being free of a resentment does not mean I'm excusing, condoning, or exonerating the behavior that brought it on. Now, that only holds true in certain situations. A lot of my resentments I brought on myself. A lot of my resentments were based on decisions based on self. Every now and then, there are real resentments that come from real things that happen to real people. Every now and then, there's somebody who's probably sitting in here right now that might have been molested when you were 6 or 7 years old and you didn't ask for that. Somebody in here right now might be a rape survivor and you didn't ask for that. Somebody in here right now might be a victim of violent crime and you didn't ask for that. Somebody in here right now really has things that really happen to real people. And so I hold on to the resentment because I think if I get rid of the resentment, I'm saying I'm excusing or condoning the behavior that brought it on. I got to stay mad at Uncle Charlie because if I don't, I'm saying it was okay what he did. And I have to look at the truth about that situation. And I never look at the truth about the way that I operate, the way that I live my life, the things that fuel and drive and direct my life. I never look at it until I take pen and the paper. I've never looked at that. I've never known those are the things that drive me. I've never known that I've wondered why I can't get close to another person because it's three people laying up in this bed all the time and one of them is that unseen one. I've never known why it is that I can't form close relationships. I've never known why it is why I don't trust anybody. I've never known why it is that I stay away from family gatherings because he or she might be there. I never know why it is that I keep running into the same walls in life because I don't know what fuels me and I don't know my belief system. I don't know the things that drive me. So we have a written inventory and we set pen to paper. And the reason it talks about searching and fearless is I'm going to have to go deep inside myself and there's going to be some things under there that I've swept under the rug. And the thing about under the rug, they're at the forefront of everything else that I do, even if because they're the things that I'm terrified you're going to know about me. It's like I wear it on my forehead. And I know I'm talking to somebody in here, and it may not be everybody, but somebody in here knows what we're talking about, you know, and I wear it. And if I want to be free of that, see, in this deal, resentment inventory is not a question of being right. Do I want to be right or do I want to be free? Do I want to be right or do I want to be free? And so I say to myself, whoever it was, they might have been in my bed with me when I was 7 or 8. You getting out of my bed now that I'm 48. It's time for you to go. It's time for you to go. And I see the truth about it, and then I do this resentment inventory. It's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I look at people, principles, and institutions at whom I'm angry. And when I look at people, the first thing I do is I do compartments so that I try not to miss people. And I do family. I do friends. I do schoolmates. I do church. I do military. Any other groups I've been a part of, clubs, baseball teams, you know, whatever else. Big groups and chunks of people, the fellowship. And I look at those groups and I call from those groups and I come up with a list of people. Principles and institutions, the institution of marriage, the IRS, you know, UCLA, I was mad at them, I owed, you know, financial aid. So institutions, you know, and principles. Honesty is the best policy. The girls can't do what the boys can do. You know, stuff like that. Those are principles that I might be angry at. And I do people, but most of us, pretty much inventories are dominated by people in some institutions. And so I write them as a list. And then I go and I do a second column. And in my second column is the cause. That's where I live most of my life. It's an easy column to do. It's the finger-pointing column. I know why I'm mad at you. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I have this vague unease, and sometimes I'm ashamed and I'm guilty about why I'm mad. My grandmother showed up on my resentment inventory, and my grandmother loved me to death. She was my mom's mother, and she was big, and she was overweight, and she was uneducated, and she was from the South, and she walked barefoot, and I was ashamed of her. I was ashamed for my friends to see her. And I wrote on my inventory, and I was ashamed of myself for being ashamed of her. When I do inventory, it's mine. And the reason it talks about searching and fearless, I take a look at this guy, Ralph White. He ain't always pretty, but it's who he is. It's who he is. And I take a look at it. You know, when I had my daughter, my 14-year-old, I was 40 years old when my wife was pregnant. My wife showed up on that inventory. I was resentful at her. I was through raising kids, as if I didn't participate in that. But I was mad at her. I was mad at her. And guess who else was on my inventory? My unborn daughter. She was on my inventory. And by the time she was born was the time I was writing. She was on my inventory before she came. I was resentful about her taking up all my time. I was through with this. I'm selfish. I don't want to be raising babies anymore. And I was ashamed about that. But by the time she was born, I was well in the recovery. And I've seen the benefits. I've seen the benefits. So, you know, I let that work for me. I look at inventory like it's a treasure hunt. And guess what the treasure is? I'm going to discover something at the end of me. What's my favorite subject anyway? Me. Okay, so do inventory. I'm making this attractive to you guys. Don't you want to write? Come on. You know, do this inventory. My favorite subject, me. And so I resolutely look for it. Because I'm not going to be in prison to somebody else. And I'm not going to be in prison to me. To myself. There's something in this deal for me, but I think that in resentments work for me. So I do that, and then I write the causes. And then in the third column, you know, and it's in the book, I don't have to invent anything. It's seven areas of self that I ask myself, which area of self is hurt, threatened, or interfered with? Is it my self-esteem? And I have some definitions that I use that aren't Webster's, but they're just for purposes of writing inventory. It's definitions I use. Is it my self-esteem, the way that I look at myself? Is it my pride, the way I think others look at me? Is it my ambitions, what I think I want to be okay? Is it my security, what I think I need to be okay? Is it my personal relationship, any relationship where sex is not involved? Is it my sexual relationship, any relationship where sex is involved, real or imagined? Or is it my pocketbook, my money, or my property? You know, and I look at those seven areas of self, and I ask myself, where would they hurt, threaten, or interfere with in relation to that cause in that second column? You know, my daddy, he lied, you know, he was weak, he was an alcoholic. What did that hurt? What part of me was hurt, threatened, or interfere with the fact that my dad was an alcoholic? It affected my self-esteem, the way I felt and looked at myself. You know, that there's something wrong with me, and I thought less of myself because I must be a reflection of my dad. You know, my pride. I thought other people looked down on me and my family, knowing he was an alcoholic. My personal relationships. I shunned relationships with people who would know that was the case, and I shunned having a relationship with my dad. You know, my ambition. I always wanted a father-son relationship that was kind of like a Cosby one, and I didn't have that. My security. You know, I didn't have, you know, that the security of a father taking care of his son, showing me what it is to be a man. It affected, you know, my sexual relations. How did your dad being an alcoholic when you were a kid affect your sexual relationships? I've always felt inadequate as a man, and I've always felt like I had to buy you, and I always felt that I am what I can give you, and if you really know me, you are not going to like me, and I'm wearing the Scarlet A alcohol on my forehead, even before I was one. Just by association, you know. My pocketbook, clearly it was hurt, threatened. It was hurt and interfered with. We didn't have money. My old man spent his check every 2 weeks. You know, we scuffled growing up. So I look at those seven areas of self, and then, you know, we look at that fourth column, resolutely putting aside the wrongs other people had done. Some people call it my mistake. Some people call it the blame. I've written them calling it my part. Bob has a big deal with that part because he thinks it implies that, wait a minute, it's not all yours. But in that fourth column, I look at myself. Where was I? Selfish, self-centered, selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, or afraid. I was selfish because I wanted my dad to be other than what. I was selfish because I wanted for him something he couldn't even get himself. I was selfish because I acted like he had a choice to be alcoholic when I know better. I'm one, and it ain't a choice, it's a disease. You know, I was dishonest. I was dishonest because I wanted him to be beyond his capability. Sometimes, in a resentment that I hold at somebody, I want to hold them up to be something they're not capable of being. And one of my resentments I had for my dad, it was because he left us. And one of the deals that I looked at that I was dishonest in that resentment was, I was dishonest because he didn't leave us. My mom put him out. Didn't even know that. I was dishonest and I was selfish because I was only thinking about myself and the way it affected me. I never thought about what that man must have went through on a janitor's salary with a janitor's education with six boys with a mom like mine that was very strong-willed and determined. I never thought about how scary that was for him. I raised two and it's scary. I never thought about it. And I made money and was very sick. I never thought about what it must have felt like to be in the grips of this disease, to be a low-wage, blue-collar guy with six boys that he was responsible for. I never thought about that. Kind of dishonest, that kind of self. So I do that when I go there. You know, there's a prayer that we say that's affiliated with doing that, too. You know, and there are a couple of prayers in the fourth step. You know, one of them is, as we say, you know, perhaps they, like ourselves, were perhaps, you know, spiritually sick. Bob's going to talk more about that part, too. I know he is. No, but they, like ourselves, were perhaps spiritually sick. We ask God to show them the same pity, patience, and tolerance that we would grant a sick friend. You know, and so I go through that deal, and I go through that fourth, and I write. and I get free of the resentments. And then I go to the fear inventory, because in, aside each one of those, when I go to my fourth column, I see the fears. You know, and the fear about my dad leaving. I had a fear of being hurt. I had a fear of being alone. I had a fear of being abandoned. I had a fear of being looked down on. I had a fear of being humiliated. I had a fear that other people thought less about my family. I had all kind of fears associated with that. And so I started drawing my fears from my fourth step in the resentment inventory. I then did it in a separate inventory called the fear inventory. You know, and it says in the fear inventory, we listed our fears. And we listed them on paper. And everything we do, if you hear people go up to the podium talking about you don't have to do a written inventory, well, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is very clear. It says we listed them on paper. We ask ourselves, why do we have a fear? Isn't it because self-reliance failed us? I have a fear of commitment, or I have a fear of being with somebody. Why? Because self-reliance failed me. Me relying on me can't make you like me. Me relying on me can't make me not come up short in your estimation. Me relying on me, I know there are going to be some things in me that you are not going to like, and there are going to be some things. Me relying, I've proven it to myself, and so there's a lot of fear in that. I've always had the fear that if you really know me, you won't like me. And so that whole fear inventory deal, we ask ourselves, you know, isn't it because self-reliance failed us? You know, so what do I do about fear? What do I do about fear? I ask God to remove the fear. I ask him to direct my attention to what he would have me to be. So how do I, that fear of commitment or that fear of relationships, how am I? I come in there faith. Because sometimes when I ask God to direct my attention to how he would have me to be, I have to ask myself, how am I without his help? Well, I'm fake. I'm dishonest. I'm lying. I'm putting forth a face that I can't maintain. So how would God have me to be? Not come in there having me try to buy your affection, to come in there just as I am. I think he would have me to be honest. I think he would have me to be forthright. I think he would. So that's how I have to look at it. How am I when I act out this fear without his help? And usually it's be the opposite of how I am. Immediately we commence to outgrow fear. We commence to outgrow fear. And then that last inventory is our sex conduct inventory, which I guess is it time for a break now, Bob?
We could.
Okay. And then we'll talk about sex inventory when we come back from the break, and Bob is going to talk about four when we come back from the break.
8 minutes, 27 seconds.